this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Is that executions in this country are a continuation of what enslaved people went through with lynchings and Jim Crow and so on.
Gloria Rubeck of the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement shares a report.
The Federal Police Officer Misconduct Database has been deleted and will no longer function. That was the database that had been established under who else? Trump himself, tracking officers, federal officers, so that they couldn't abuse someone in the course of their duties, maybe be facing termination or discipline, resign, and then pop up at another department.
Human rights attorney Adante Poynter discusses the dangers of Trump's erasure of the police misconduct database and the threat to civil liberties under the Alien Enemies Act.
This cooperation between right-wing governments and employers is nothing new here. And the only way we will beat this is through unity and, you know, organizing the actions that are needed to disrupt the business as usual. We're going to have strikes. We're going to have massive strikes.
United Electrical Workers President Carl Rosen discusses the history of labor witch hunts and their relevance to attacks on unionists today. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Texas has led the nation in the number of executions since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976. Gloria Rubeck of the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement shares this report on recent developments on the ground.
I'm Gloria Rubeck, reporting from Houston, Texas. I am with the prison show on KPFT Pacifica Radio in Houston. And I'm an organizer for the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. And I want to talk a little bit about the death penalty. And I have to begin by saying on Thursday, March 20th, there were actually two executions, one in Oklahoma and one in Florida. On March 19th, there was an execution in Arizona. And on March 18th, there was the first execution in Louisiana in 15 years. And they used the latest torture method of executing, which is nitrogen asphyxiation, really. It's a method of killing a person that is torture. The gas goes through a gas mask while the person is strapped to a gurney. And the witnesses who were in Louisiana on the 18th said that the gentleman was twitching and clenching his hands and jerking through the whole process. And this is the same reactions that the other state that's using this nitrogen gas, Alabama, that's what those witnesses have said. Of course, the state of Louisiana said, oh, everything went just fine. But torturing somebody isn't just fine. And actually, this method of killing is something that veterinarians won't use on animals because they said it's torture. Normally, I would start out by saying things are looking very good when it comes to the death penalty compared to the last three or four decades, because public support for executions is down. The Gallup poll said that we're at the lowest public support in decades, and so support is down, the number of executions are down, and the number of death sentences are down. And it used to be that when somebody was executed, boy, somebody was convicted and they filled that bed on death row. But That isn't happening. And I know in Texas, where I am, for years, we had between 400 and 450 people on death row. We're almost up to 600 executions, but they're not filling the beds. And I think we're down to about 170 people on Texas death row. I do want to say, since 2009, seven states have abolished the death penalty. Their legislature said no more. That is good news. The first southern state to get rid of the death penalty was Virginia. And boy, it used to rank right behind Texas in the number of executions. So that was quite a step for a southern former Confederate state. So right now, 27 states have the death penalty, but four of them have a moratorium on executions. That's 23 states that could be using executions. For 2025, there were 28 executions scheduled by nine states. Now, one of those states and one of these 28 dates was Ohio, where the governor has said they're not going to execute anybody till they can figure out how to do it. They can't get drugs and so on. And I have to say also, I think it was March 7th, in South Carolina, they actually used a firing squad. We're in 2025, and they're using a firing squad. That's pretty disgusting. I want to say just a little bit about some things that we're doing in Texas. And right now, our legislature is in session. Fortunately, they're only in session every other year, so they only screw things up every other year. But there's quite a number of bills being proposed in the legislature, from abolishing the death penalty to raising the age of executions to 21. And you know, it was in 2005, they said juveniles couldn't be executed. So they, no more 16 and 17 year olds, you had to be 18. Now, I mean, I just read a study today about how the same mentality that 18 year olds have goes all the way up to your mid 20s. So we actually have a bill to raise the age to 21. We have bills to abolish the death penalty. We have bills to renew the way we look at scientific evidence. This is probably because of the case of Robert Robertson, who was accused of killing his 2-year-old daughter. And that case has gotten a lot of publicity because the science that they convicted him on, which is shaken baby syndrome, scientists are now saying there's really not such a thing and that should not be used in court. So we've got bills on that. We've got bills on post-conviction DNA testing. Rodney Reed, an innocent man on death row, since the 90s, I think 94, just won in the Supreme Court to have DNA testing. He's been asking for it forever. And another man who was scheduled to be executed this year in Texas, Ruben Gutierrez, got a stay because he's asking for DNA testing. There's a lot of bills. There's a bill on the law of parties where most states have what they call felony murder. So if you're the lookout driver and somebody's committing the crime, you all can be charged. But I believe Texas is one of the few states that will execute somebody that didn't kill somebody under what we call the law of parties. And there's a number of people on death row right now under the law of parties. So there's a bill to do away with that. There's also bills to limit solitary confinement, which is used, way too much. People on death row have been in Texas, have been in solitary confinement since 2020. Many of them who were totally sane when they went in are no longer sane. One of the state reps has a bill to limit solitary confinement to 3 days or to 10 days if there was violence involved in whatever infraction they committed, and they got sent to solitary. So that's kind of exciting. We are doing, the group I'm with, the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, we've got 2 days of lobby training coming up this Saturday and the next, March 22nd and March 29th. And this is to prepare us for a death penalty lobby day that we've been doing probably for the last 20 years. And we've made a few good steps. It's been hard. And with Governor Abbott, it's probably going to be very hard now. We've got a state representative named Christina Morales, who has co-introduced a bill to abolish the death penalty. She's coming out to train us. And then on March 29th, State Representative Jean Wu will be training us. And we're really excited about both of these state reps. Representative Morales has a bill to abolish the death penalty. Jean Wu is the vice chair of the House, Texas House Criminal Jurisprudence Committee. And I got to add, Greg Abbott made this unilateral decision this session based on who knows what, that none of the chairs of any committee in the Texas legislature can be held by a Democrat. We're excited that Jean Wu, who is a Democrat, got named vice chair. When I was lobbying a few weeks ago with the teachers union, boy, Representative Wu was militant. So looking forward to him coming to the SHAPE Community Center on March 29th to train us. I guess I would just end by saying that there's a lot of activity going on. There was 28 execution dates set for 2025. 10 of those have been carried out as of the 20th of March. So that leaves 18. Out of those 18, 7 of those death warrants are inactive. And then there's 11 that are active, but 2 of those are in Ohio, which they're not going to happen. So that really leaves 9 executions for 2025 in the country. Texas has 2 coming up, April 23rd, Moises Mendoza, and let's see, May 20th, Matthew Johnson. But it's interesting. April 8th is in Florida. April 11th is in South Carolina. April 23rd in Texas. April 24th in Alabama. May 20th in Texas. May 22nd in Tennessee. August 5th in Tennessee. Actually, there's a few more. September in Tennessee. And December 11th in Tennessee. But if you'll notice, all of those states I just mentioned are southern states, former Confederate states. And one of the principles that our organization, the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, firmly believes, and many others do too, is that executions in this country are a continuation of what enslaved people went through with lynchings and Jim Crow and so on. And one of the best books I ever read was called From the Rope to the Chair to the Needle. I think that is still what's going on today. They're having trouble getting the drugs, so now they're doing firing squads and putting gas into your lungs and torturing people. President Biden commuted all but 3 of the people on federal death row. I believe it was 39 people. So their death sentences were commuted to life. What our new president wants to do is the states that those 39 people who were commuted, the states they were in, and I believe 6 of them were here in Texas, he wants the state to resentence them to state crimes instead of federal crimes. And that way they can all be executed. So this is just one more feather Trump wants to put in his cap of destroying lives. That's a general wrap-up of what's going on in the United States with the death penalty. When I witnessed an execution of a dear friend in 1993, that was before the victim's family could witness. So we were in a room together, maybe 10 feet apart, talking until he was executed. And he said, "Gloria, before they kill me, I just want you to make me one promise." And I said, "Sure." And he said, "Promise me you won't stop fighting the death penalty." Well, people who know me know that I keep my promises to friends. I am not going to stop fighting, and neither are abolitionists around the country, until the death penalty is in its grave. So this is Gloria Ruback in Houston, Texas, reporting for The Prison Show on Pacifica Radio here, 90.1 KPFT, and for the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. We do not have a web page, but we have a very active Facebook page and Instagram account. And I think one of the young people is still doing TikTok. But if you look for us on Facebook, it's The Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. And you got to put the B. This is Gloria Ruback reporting from Houston, Texas on the death penalty.
If I never went home again.
That was Gil Scott-Heron, "Home is Where the Hatred Is." This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasilyev. The Trump administration has erased the National Police Misconduct Database and invoked the 1798 Alien Enemies Act. Adante Poynter, human rights attorney with Lawyers for the People, spoke to Pacifica's J.R. Valray about the implications.
We have a lot to talk about in dealing with police terrorism, what's going on with the Trump regime, as well as the 1798 Alien Enemies Act. Adante, how are you?
I'm well, brother. You know, a lot of work to do nowadays. I mean, there always is a lot of work when it comes to fighting injustice, but it seems to be even more nowadays, just given all the activity that's taking place.
Recently, the Trump regime has erased a national database that keeps track of the human rights abuses committed by police officers in the United States. Can you give us a little bit of history, as well as what are your thoughts on this new phenomenon in Trump's America?
Well, you know, Trump's America, at least the vision that he sees and his enablers have provided to him and crafted, and frankly have a wraparound strategy to bring from a vision to reality, we're seeing take place right in front of our eyes. And one of the things of the vision that Trump has and what he's committed to doing is cutting down the federal bureaucracy which means getting rid of employees in different departments and agencies and tasks that these employees are supposed to be doing. Well, in the course of shutting down and firing people, a casualty of those decisions and policy choices is that the Federal Police Officer Misconduct Database has been deleted and will no longer function. And what that was a database that had been established under who else? Trump himself during his first term in order to make sure that there was a database tracking officers, federal officers, so that they couldn't abuse someone in the course of their duties, maybe be facing termination or discipline, resign, and then pop up at another department or pop up in a different type of police department, be it a local police department or a state police department, and no one would know that they had been abusive of other people. Sort of like what we saw happening with the Catholic priest scandal, where a priest would be abusing somebody in their community, and then when the community found out and there'd be criminal charges or parishioners would get upset, then they would just transfer that priest to another parish, to another community, and that would allow the priest to continue on with their predatory and criminal conduct, unbeknownst to the community that they had been assigned to. Well, here in this situation, you know, with the federal database, it was set up to prevent those type of abuses from continuing. It was set up and it encompassed over 150,000 federal officers and agents, either from the FBI, IRS, all the way down to the Railroad Retirement Board. So it was every federal agency that had police assigned to it. And it was a database storing records that the agencies had sent to it from as far back as 2017. So it was one of the first nationwide cumulative databases. And frankly, if you ask me, it was being put in place and it would be able to be used as a model for what we should have in our country anyway, which is a national database tracking police departments in each state, in each city, in each county, in each parish, to make sure that they don't move around and continue their abuse. And that has fallen victim because the funding was stripped. And this is something that the National Association of Police Officers had long been criticizing as it relates to this database. And frankly, they got their wish granted in the second term of Trump because the database is no longer. And as I mentioned, it's something that Trump proposed in the wake of George Floyd's killing, which actually went into effect and was put in place during Biden and maintained Biden's presidency and maintained. And now it's gone. Hopefully a different president at a different time will see the wisdom in having these type of databases and will do what has been done, which is create one. But for now, all that data is lost and there's no way to really track what's going on with federal police officers and agents.
Only two times in U.S. history, and it was during wartime, has the president enacted the 1798 Alien Enemies Act. Why is this important for people in the United States to keep watch? What happened under the 1798 Alien Enemies Act when it was enacted the last two times under U.S. presidents?
Yes, the 1798 Alien Enemies Act is an act that gives the president war powers. During times of war, as one could imagine, the federal government needs to move quickly to do certain things. And so there are laws and bills that have been passed that allow a lot of power to the president and bypass Congress or the legislature and even the courts in order to make things happen. And so under the 1798 Alien Enemies Act, this president, our current president, Trump, is using it to identify what he thinks are, would have been up till now, Latin-based criminal gangs or organizations, and he's using the powers to deport these people who we claim are, who law enforcement identify as being a part of these gangs without them having to go see an immigration court or be heard in front of an immigration judge. So essentially, they have no right to fight a case or to make their case in court or to have a judge decide whether or not they're a part of this gang, whether or not they're in the country illegally. Instead, a law enforcement agency can just say, hey, we believe you're a part of this gang or you are a part of this gang and come get you from your house, your home, your place of work, anywhere in the community, put you in handcuffs as we've seen, have you in a detention center, load you on a plane and take you back to the country that they want to take you to. And in this instance, it was used to take people back to Venezuela based upon Trump's bureaucracy saying that these people were part of the Venezuelan gang. This has been used, as you mentioned, previous times, actually three previous times, one in the War of 1812, World War I, and World War II. And if you're asking what has been done under this, under previous times this act has been brought into power, you could look at World War II, where during World War II, immigrants such as German, Italians, and Japanese, and primarily Japanese, were rounded up, their property taken, and they were put into essentially modern day, or at that time, essentially like concentration camps, minus the ovens and the killings, but still rounded up into incarcerated facilities, deprived of their rights under this Wartime Powers Act. And so this is something that we see being threatened under our current president, where people are being rounded up. They're talking about being held in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba or private prisons in different parts of our country, not being given the right to state their case, and essentially being held in a sense of purgatory where you're not a citizen and you're not in our country able to move around, and you have to stay in a facility, but then also maybe not even being sent back to your home country, or in some instances being sent back to your home country where you fled because of political or economic instability, some of which or all of which could have been caused by the U.S. and our foreign policy, or the president or the bureaucracy of their home country being a threat to them. All of that doesn't matter. Instead, if you're labeled as being a part of one of these Latin gangs or Latin organizations or a Latin of descent, and you're misidentified as being a part of one of these organizations, you can be swooped up, sent back home, or incarcerated, and you don't have any type of procedural rights in a way to try to contest what's happening to you. And this has all been done, you know, right under our nose, but is using an older law, which I'll just add, the 1798 Alien Enemies Act was also passed at the same time as the 1798 Sedition Act. And that act, which we have heard whispers about that being something that could potentially come into place and be used by Trump as well, that makes it a crime for an American citizen to print, utter, or publish any false, scandalous, or malicious writing against the federal government. And so that would be a huge limitation and restraint placed upon freedom of speech, which, as your listeners know, is our First Amendment speech. It's the first civil constitutional right that's in our Constitution. And if the president enacts the Sedition Act, your ability to criticize, your ability to voice your opposition to the federal government could make you subject to being placed in jail. And we see some of that happening, shades of that happening, when you think about the two men, as far as I'm aware, who were slated to be arrested and deported, one of which wound up leaving voluntarily before Homeland Security got to him. But the other man, who was a student, I believe, at Columbia, he was arrested and deported back to his country. Why? Because they said that he had been outspoken on his support for the Palestinian cause. And so this is a very slippery slope. We have not seen that take place in that manner under, you know, modern times. However, you know, Trump is willing to reach all the way back to 1798 in order to shape America into the vision that he sees it in, as well as to appease his supporters and his enablers.
I mean, you said that the Alien Enemies Act is being used to fight, quote unquote, Latin gangs. Now, what is the definition of an enemy, and can that definition be changed? As you were also speaking on the Sedition Act, can that title enemy be used to encompass everybody?
Sure. This is what you just hit on is a very important issue that you're going to see play out in the courts and ultimately, hopefully, to be reported on in the news. Although, you know, we have to rely upon people like you who have their eye on the ball and understand how one step, one inch can lead to a mile. And so what the legislature does, Congress, they pass rules. So Congress passed this rule. What the courts do is interpret the rule. And so what Trump is doing is it relates to focusing this not on someone who necessarily lives in the country and you know, like it was used in World War II, but instead saying, hey, we're not even in formal war with Venezuela like we were with Germany, Italy, and Japan during World War II. Instead, he's saying, hey, this group of people, they have invaded our country, and therefore this group is subject to the 1798 Alien Enemies Act. That's never been done before, where an act like this has been used to identify not a state actor, i.e. not a country, but instead to say, hey, this is a non-state actor, a group of people, of civilians from another place who are here, and they, quote unquote, invaded our country. So it's going to be up to the court, a judge at some point in time, to decide whether or not you can use this law, use this act of Congress as a way to deal with essentially immigrant policy, immigration policy. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how the courts wind up judging or ruling on this. But as many of you know who have been watching the courts, one thing that I think is a positive about what all this stuff Trump is doing has been people are coming more aware to the idea that the rules are really subject to the interpretation of a judge's political leanings. Conservative judges who are appointed by conservative presidents or by the conservative party, which is the Republican Party in today's form of politics, tend to side more with the government, tend to side more with the state when it comes to situations like this. Whereas the Democrats or the liberals would tend to side with saying, well, you shouldn't use this type of act in this way. So depending upon what judge you get sitting over and presiding over this issue is going to determine whether or not this law can be used in the way Trump is trying to use it.
Columbia University just suspended, expelled, and revoked degrees from 22 students for protesting genocide in Palestine. You talked a little bit about it with the case of Mahmoud Khalil, but can you go into what is really at stake if campus protest is penalized in such a way? We know that a lot of counterculture in the United States was built from how student movements have been going for decades in the United States. They are very much a builder of counterculture in the United States. What are your thoughts?
You know, a very sad day, because what we see here is some of what some people may remember or have studied or understand about what happened during the 70s when people were protesting the Vietnam War at places like UC Berkeley, Berkeley, California. You know, police came in and water hosed, and, you know, riot police came and harassed and beat people who were marching for free speech and also to end the Vietnam War. And so what you see here is you don't see it at that same scale, but you're seeing it applied. Because as you mentioned, universities and campuses and colleges are where they're supposed to be almost like a safe zone for debate, a safe zone for the clash of ideas, a safe zone for the incubation and the nurturing of political, economic, social discourse. But instead, what you're seeing now, it looks like universities are picking sides. They're picking sides about who they support in the debate, who they support in a conflict, and punishing a side that the side that they don't like, or what they now consider the ops. That's a popular term in our culture right now, ops. And what we're seeing is universities who have billion-dollar endowments, who have thousands of powerful alumni, and who have a megaphone as it relates to their ability to get their message out, looks and appears to be saying, hey, you know, we're siding against people who are supporting Palestinians. And then you couple that with the Alien Act that Trump has enacted, and you could see the two merging up to a situation where people who are identified as supporting a cause that the current administration is against can then find themselves not only kicked out of school or their degrees withdrawn and taken back, but also kicked out the whole entire country. And so this is a very slippery slope, and people should very much be watching, taking notice, and also understand that just because they're coming for someone else now, just because they're targeting a different group now, doesn't mean that you could be in their crosshairs at some later point in time.
You were just listening to the voice of human rights lawyer Adante Poynter of Lawyers for the People. Thank you, Adante, for spending this time and informing us on some of these current events in the United States during Trump season.
Thank you for having me, brother. You know, this is a time where everyone certainly needs to keep their eyes open, be alert and watch the play. It's like chess. It's not the immediate play that's in front of you. It's what's the goal in the long game, what's the end game. And that way we can try to beat the end game before it gets there and prevent more people from being harmed.
That was human rights attorney Adante Poynter of Lawyers for the People speaking to J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio, blockreportradioworld.com.
Every man got the right to decide his own destiny. And in this judgment there is no partiality. So arm in arms with arms, we'll fight this little struggle. Cause that's the only way we can overcome a little trouble.
That was Bob Marley and the Wailers, Zimbabwe. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Attacks on teachers' unions around the country echo the labor and anti-communist repression of the 1940s and 50s. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer spoke with United Electrical Workers Union President Carl Rosen about the union's roots in the 1930s and how the U.S. government, corporations, and pro-capitalist union leaders have attacked and raided labor organizations.
For our listeners, Carl, why don't you talk about the UE, its formation, and what happened, how it was formed, and what formed the union?
Well, we were an original CIO union, and we were built from the bottom up. So workers had started self-organizing independent locals at a number of large manufacturing plants. These are plants with 5, 10, 15,000 workers making electrical parts for companies like General Electric and Westinghouse and Sylvania, RCA, companies like that, mostly on the East Coast initially. They reached out to each other and said, hey, we need to get the whole industry organized. Let's form a national union to do that. And they gathered a small convention from, I think, 7 different locals in Buffalo in the middle of a snowstorm in the winter of 1936 and established themselves, drafted a preamble that has absolutely stood the test of time about being created, committed to aggressive struggle to move the working class forward, and a very radical non-discrimination clause, radical for that time in terms of covering everyone, race, religion, et cetera, gender, but also regardless of your political beliefs. They did not want people being discriminated against, based on any particular thoughts that they might have themselves. And all of that was very important. Our union got really challenged as we moved into the McCarthy era because we quickly became a huge union. We were the third largest union in the US in the period just after World War II. We proudly did our part in the huge strikes that took place in 1946 when workers tried to regain some of what they had lost during the war, when there were freezes on wages, but not on profits. And a big strike wave, UE, the UAW for auto workers, the steel workers for that industry too. And we all made big gains. And that led to the president of GE having a famous statement, a speech where he said, America faces two enemies, Russia abroad and labor at home. And that was really the declaration of the McCarthy era, and really was what that whole period was about. It wasn't about defeating communism. It was about defeating a militant and unified labor movement that had the ability to actually win some measure of justice for working people. So we went into a very dark period at that point, lost a lot of members due to raids from other unions. Nine unions were eliminated. UE survived and has carried forward its independent outlook towards how we need to fight as workers, how we need to maintain ourselves politically ever since that time.
And of course, the ILWU was the other union that the government tried to crush, throw Harry Bridges, its founder, out of the country, and made a big attempt to destroy that union as well. And of course, the last general strike in the United States was in 1946 in Oakland.
Right. Very parallel history. We've always considered ourselves to be sister unions with the West Coast longshore workers, and very proud of that. And at the same time that government was trying to throw Harry Bridges out of the country, they were trying to throw Jim Mattis, who was one of our national officers and was a Hungarian immigrant. They were trying to throw him out of the country. The parallels to what is happening right now with the attempt to deport Mahmoud Khalil for standing up on behalf of his beliefs. Not violating any laws, simply speaking his mind. In fact, literally being a spokesperson for a campaign for justice in Palestine. And my understanding is he was actually a grad worker himself, so a union member for some part of the time that this activity was going on. And then news just broke that Colombia has now discharged the president of the grad workers union at Columbia the day before bargaining is to start. This is exactly like what happened in the McCarthy era, where McCarthy-type committees would come into cities where there was a labor fight underway by UE or one of the other 11 unions that were refusing to kowtow to the establishment at that time. And they would come in and they would subpoena the entire leadership of those locals that were about to be on strike, or maybe were already on strike, and the company would fire all of the leaders on the basis that, oh, since they were subpoenaed, they must be a national security threat and they can't work here anymore. And leaving the union, essentially leaderless, and then another conservative union would swoop in and try to take the members away. So this cooperation between right-wing governments and employers is nothing new here. And the only way we will beat this is through unity and organizing the actions that are needed to disrupt the business as usual. We're going to have strikes. We're going to have massive strikes.
And of course, Project 2025 says in it that they're against unions among public workers. They're for company unions. They would like to get rid of independent unions, form company unions, and they want to attack democratic rights. So what you're saying, though, is that actually this witch hunt against union graduate unions and their leadership is a replica and similar to what happened in the 50s when communist militants and other unions were targeted by the government and some union officials who benefited from that as well. You say there were raids on the UE, there were raids on other unions to get rid of these unions entirely.
Absolutely. And this pattern of targeting immigrant workers as being, you know, the most vulnerable also, you know, occurred at that time, as you just mentioned, in terms of they're going after Harry Bridges and then Jim Matlis from our union, who I believe at that point was actually had actually, you know, become a naturalized citizen. But that didn't stop them. You know, the laws did not were not getting in their way any more than they're getting in the way of Trump unless we stop them from mass action. I'm actually heartened the amount of protest that's going on, and it's led to, you know, newspapers that in the 50s were on the opposite side on this. I mean, the Chicago Tribune in the 1950s, when one of our shops got hit with these subpoenas by one of the McCarthy committees, a big Stuart Warner electrical auto parts plant, the Chicago Tribune listed the names of the people who had been subpoenaed on the front page so that they then became blacklisted and couldn't get other jobs in the industry. That was clearly what their intent was there. They were part and parcel of what was going on. This week, the Chicago Tribune ran an article, an editorial, saying that we need to protect freedom of speech and that this is wrong, what the government is doing. We can win this fight. We can save Mahmoud. And, you know, the petition that was put out there, in just a few days, it has over 3 million signatures. I mean, that's just phenomenal. And we just need to encourage it and make it grow. And the protests that are happening, there was a group from Jewish Voices for Peace, 100 folks who sat in the lobby of the Trump Tower today. You know, they all took arrests. They were willing to take arrest for it. This is the kind of actions we're going to have, you know, to turn this around.
And the rise of fascism, of course, is not unique. There was a fascist movement in the 30s. That mm-hmm. led to the rise of Hitler. And today you have a government that believes it's above the law. The Supreme Court ruled that if you declare your action as president an official act, you can get away with it. What do you think about the rise of fascism in the United States and what it means for working class people and unions?
Yeah, well, look, what we're seeing here is a curtailment of the people's democratic rights in the service of big business. You know, there's been long time argument on the left that we're able to have democratic rights in this country until our exercise of them as working people threatens the wealth and power of the ultra rich, at which point they're going to try to curtail it. And you know, we have a section. I don't think the ruling class is united on this necessarily, or you know, all of corporate America is united on wanting this kind of Trump approach to things, this Elon Musk approach to things. But they're damn well going to be willing to take advantage of it, and if they can use it to weaken the unions at their workplaces, et cetera, they will. So it's why we need to, as working people, stand up and defend our democratic rights. But we have to understand this is not the frame of it being democracy versus fascism is not the whole story. What the whole story is, it's the working class against the oligarchs. And that's what we need to be very clear about.
And there's been a rise of protest against Elon Musk, Tesla, mm-hmm. all over the country. And many of the people that are there are against fascism. They're worried that we've got a fascist government. They're also against oligarchs. Would you say that's the beginning of a anti-capitalist movement, that people are fed up more and more and see the threat of fascism is a threat that threatens all working people, all people of the United States?
Well, I'd say there's been a burgeoning anti-capitalist movement for the last couple decades, frankly, since the turn of the century, when in you know, economic downturn after economic downturn, people are worse and worse off after each one. And there's not any real recovery. And the rich keep getting richer and everybody else is barely getting by. When we're at the point where two-thirds of the folks, even during a supposed good economy like we had, you know, that was the claim of the last year of the Biden administration, right? Oh, this economy is great. Literally two-thirds of people are living paycheck to paycheck. That's not a good economy. That's not an economy that's delivering for working people. So everything that you've seen, including the much greater support for unions right now, the willingness of young people to organize, to self-organize, right, which is what we had in the 1930s. And we're seeing that again now. It's why we have so many graduate workers organized, is because they self-organized, because they realized nobody else is going to take care of things for them. They're in a bad situation. And they're going to have to organize themselves to get out of it. They can't rely on the employer to do it. They can't rely on the government to do it. The working people have to do it for themselves. And so I would say that movement has already been building, and it's frankly because of that that we're getting this reaction of the kind of government that we have now, where they're trying to repress folks. Of course, the other reason we have the kind of government we have now is because the Democratic Party at a national level has been just absolutely rotten to its core, and making sure that anything that actually would start to help with some of the problems that working people face, like the programs that Bernie Sanders has put forward, you know, make sure that they're throttled, you know, before they can get into place. I mean, the way they systematically worked to make sure that he wouldn't have a fair shot at winning the Democratic nomination either in 2016 or 2020. I mean, just absolutely guaranteed, and then made sure there wasn't a primary in 2024. I mean, all of these things were to make sure that working people wouldn't actually have a legitimate voice within the Democratic Party. And so we got what we got now.
And one of the things that's taking place now with the Trump administration is the idea that we have to have a trade war against Canada, against other countries, to resuscitate American capitalism. American capitalism can't compete against China. It can't compete against other countries. So we're going to revive the power of American capitalism and imperialism with a trade war. What's your view about that plan based on the decline of capitalism and the need to be more competitive?
Yeah, well, I'm very dubious that this is about trying to make sure that capitalism can be revived. I think, A, it's a product of Trump's somewhat bizarre politics at times, and he makes promises and he tries to carry them out, and he just doesn't have a rational approach to much of anything, even to what the needs of capitalists are necessarily, except that he has a rational approach to particular capitalists that he's in bed with. I mean, it's crony capitalism. So he's going to do things that help take care of certain folks himself, number one. And a lot of the rest of this, I think, is probably posturing. I mean, look, there is a well of anger in the working class, as there ought to be, that our whole industrial base got moved out of this country. That was done thanks to U.S. foreign and military policy, and unfortunately with the connivance of a section of the labor movement here that helped ensure that only corrupt unions would be able to survive overseas, as left unions were squashed in many countries, especially in Latin America. So, you know, we had a policy, and that was really what the fight was about, the split in the AFL-CIO, or in the CIO, I should say. They hadn't merged yet with the AFL. And in 1949, when we left, it was, you know, will labor have an independent position on foreign policy or not? And by most of labor agreeing they wouldn't, that they would just follow blindly behind whatever the two-party consensus was on foreign policy, it made it clear that it allowed a U.S. foreign and military policy that was designed to make the rest of the world safe for American corporations to move over there, to exploit the folks there, and to ultimately gut the manufacturing base in the U.S. So there is a well of anger for good reason here, and part of how Trump got elected was by tapping into that. So he wants to at least make a show of bringing some manufacturing back here. And, you know, and it's not impossible that some of the steps he'll take may assist in that, but it's all going to be so disruptive the way he's going about it, that it's going to result also very likely in a lot of damage to the economic situation for many Americans.
That was Carl Rosen, United Electrical Workers President, speaking with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Akua Holt, Gloria Rubeck, J.R. Valray, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.